took pictures and claimed that we were, you know, obstructing and and that we were telling people bad things and all this. And so they stopped the boycott for 90 days, the 90 days cooling off period. But they let us know that if we ever resumed the boycott, that we better watch out because they'd be right on top of us all the time. Well, in the meantime, we got rid of the shed. We set up, I guess it was the smallest union in the United States, over 13 peanut shellers or whatever they were, in order to get out from under the NRA so we could continue with the secondary boycott. You aren't going to use all this stuff, but it's part of the history and it's good to know, in case anybody ever asks about it. So, in any case, while we were finishing up the odds and ends of that particular boycott in May of 1967, we got word that the Teamsters had moved into Gotham. So the Teamsters come in again, you see. So a group of organizers and I rushed up to Dowell, and we started counter-picketing the Teamsters. Teamster pickets. They were out there pretending like they were, they had to make them look good. They had already, had it all figured out undoubtedly with Gallup, and they just had to make it look good, pretending like they were exerting pressure and so forth. And we started counter-picketing. Well, then Gallup knew that it was going to happen. He was in for a union. There wasn't any question about it. And after we'd been picketing up there for about a week or 10 days, I had rented places for us to live up there, and so we thought it was going to be a long, drawn-out project. Rented two houses up there for us to live in. Got word from Delano one day, come on home, it's all over. The Teamsters are backing out, and Gallo has agreed to negotiate, and we're going to meet with the Teamsters and sign a pact. So we all raced down to Los Angeles and met with the Teamsters and the bartenders and the auto workers and, so on, and signed the pact, the first pact. That's another first, with the Teamsters, whereby they agreed to stay out of the fields, and we agreed to stay off the trucks and out of the cannons, as though we ever had any intention of going into them. But that was the first one. And we couldn't find anybody who that could talk Portuguese that would work with us up there. They're mostly Portuguese growers, they didn't want to have anything to do with it. So I had to go over to San Jose and get a Portuguese radio announcer, to bring him over, and he became a temporary organizer for us, working with him. They all knew him. They all knew about him because they listened to his program every day. But they didn't speak enough Spanish, so the Spanish-speaking person could do it, unless that person also was Portuguese, and we didn't have anybody. So we went around and signed up all the Portuguese on our own authorization cards. And what's that guy's name who used to work for the migrant ministry that worked up there? His father's name was Luke, I think.
Oh, yeah, look at here.
Anyway, he signed up most of the Chicanos, and I signed up.
Cruz.
Huh?
Lupe de la Cruz.
Yeah, that's the one. And I signed up the Anglo workers there, and then Dolores went up and negotiated with them for a contract. Then we had to start negotiating. We had set up in San Francisco, we'd set up a church leaders commission of inquiry who also helped us work on Pirelli Minetti. They went down and called on him down in the Delano there. And so then he and the Teamsters started meeting with us before this church group up in San Francisco. So all these things, including the boycott, help bring that thing to a close. And the upshot of it was then that we accepted that lousy contract that, in other words, they turned over the contract that they'd signed with the Teamsters to us. So whenever they say it can't be done, they're saying about the lettuce contracts and about the grape contracts and all that, well, it can be done, it's already been done. We've already got that kind of precedent that was later done over in the valley with the lettuce. So that was another first. We accepted a lousy Teamster contract. But we did improve it later on. When it, we couldn't do anything about it at that time. We had to wait till it ran its course, and then the second time around, we improved it. I don't know much, but a little bit. Not as bad as it was.
We hope to renovate it.
Yeah, and when does it come up again?
April.
Oh, okay. Well, that was Burley Manet and Gallo, see. Of course, as soon as that contract was signed at Gallo, the workers then began to get up off of their knees for the first time, because we had a seniority clause in there, we had a hiring clause in there, they got more wages, they got vacation pay, they got rest period for daytime, they got cups to drink out of, they got one toilet for every 15 to 20 people instead of one for every 50 people, and they cut out a lot of the a lot but not all of that speed up stuff that they had gone into, and they gave the workers gloves and warned before they when they went into the fields that had been sprayed, you know, and they warned them before sending them in. They wouldn't let them go in until a certain length of time after the fields had been sprayed. But the main thing, of course, was the seniority clause and the hiring hall clause. The workers themselves had to sort of enforce that contract part of the time, because we didn't have the organizers to send up. We immediately got involved in other strikes and so forth. But part of the time we did have organizers up there. Marshall was there for a little, and Robert Bustos and Eddie, forgot his last name, and several others. Well, then, of course, finally, Maggie Rose. And from that time on, that contract really got forced from the time Maggie took over. Well, she'll be with us tomorrow, and she can tell us a lot about it. We need to know about it all, working and so on. So, although that was not the best contract, it was a tremendous improvement over anything we'd had up until that time, including the Georgia contract, which wasn't all that good either, you know, as far as wages were concerned. But each time, you see, we were making more progress and getting more concessions from the growers. And that paved the way for the rest of the wine grape contracts. Soon after that, we got Christian Brothers and Almaden. We got Franzia, which is up there near, well, it's actually part of Gallo, Franzia Wine Company. And we got Palmasson and so on. They came fairly rapidly after we got Gallo to sign the contract.
Did we actually strike into those companies, or
No, we struck some, but I don't know which. We struck Christian Brothers, I'm pretty sure.
Well, I thought the Christian Brothers along the march, I mean, that he recognized the union before Chandy.
Well, they recognized it, but they wouldn't, I don't know whether it was before, but it was while they were balking at the contract. They were playing hard to get on that contract that we had to resume the strike. I remember. We could get that information from, see, is anybody else coming from the Fresno area that was around when all that was taking place?
How was there what you call?
No. I think Christian never struck.
What?
They never struck.
Never struck at all? Oh, I thought they did. I thought we had a problem there with the head management for a while. Well, we'll find out.
It's been a problem all the way.
Yeah.
What?
Brother so-and-so.
Was it because of the scare of the boycott that most of these companies fell?
Yeah, it was. Well, plus the fact that we've gotten the kingpin. Gallo was so much more powerful than any of them, and they figured, well, if we can get Gallo, we must have really thrown the fear of God into him.
That was in 67.
Right, yeah.
When did Palmasson start in Solitaire?
I think he began working in 68.
Luna was very active. Luna and Manuel were very active in all that over there.
Yeah, Luna, Manuel, and then go to the building.
So that was, when you get to discussion of Gallo in your house meetings, be sure and hit hard on what happened as a result of the getting the contract set. You don't have to spend much time on what happened to Giorgio or Shinley. Save that for Gallo, because we're going against Gallo now, and we want to tie in as much of this as we can, that's appropriate with the Gallo.
Fred, not only, I mean, just emphasizing that, not only to inform people about that, but, people were going to work in with Gallo, or like from Army, and Lamont, and Bakersfield, and so they went all the way down to work.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
That's right, they did.
That was last year.
Excuse me, Fred, do you still need cassettes from your own tape?
Well, then when that was all over, we all came back and went around making a real fancy survey of what branch we were going to take on next. It wasn't very fancy, of course. And so it was decided we were going to go up against Yamara. That was the biggest one. We had to take on the biggest one. No, that was in 67. And he was organized by crew pushers and trucks. He helped a lot of his crew pushers buy their trucks. In other words, he'd buy the trucks for them, and then they'd pay him back out of the money that he paid them. So he had them under his thumb. We tried to organize. We tried to get them to, come in and be part of of our own organizing drive, and they wouldn't do it. So we had organizers assigned to each of the crew pushers. And they went around and talked to, then they found out where all the workers lived that worked for each crew pusher. There were about 25 or 30 crew pushers. We had about that many organizers. So that's how we organized it. And then on the night that we called the workers together to vote whether they were going to go on strike or not, I guess we had about, out of a crew of around 1,200, we had about 250 that had the guts to come out and strike. Well, it took guts, because naturally the growers, Jamara had his spies there to see who was there, who did what, and so on. So they came out anyway, and we lined them all up according to crew before they left the hall that night. We had our organizer that represented their crew pusher, brought him out in the middle of the room, and then had all the people from his crew that were at that meeting come out and join him, and he got their names. And that was part of the organizing crew then. We did that with each of the crew pushers. So that meeting broke up at 11 o'clock at night. 4 hours later, we were meeting again and dispatching those crews out to the homes of the crew pushers in the dark. And they went out in the dark and started picketing up and down in front of the homes of the crew pushers. The crew pushers went out to get in their trucks to go pick up the workers, and they saw the turned on the lights of their trucks and saw the picket line out there, So they turned off the lights and turned off the motor and went back in the house. Not all of them, but most of them, because they didn't like what they saw. And those that didn't, those that went through the lines, were immediately followed by the strikers and in their cars. And wherever the truck would stop, why the strikers would rush out and talk to the workers and try and talk them out of getting on the trucks. And they were successful in quite a few of the cases that where they weren't, they followed the trucks to the ranch and put picket lines, across the road, in front of the trucks. So that went on for 4 days, and in 4 days, out of around 1,200 workers, we had gotten all but about 100 out of the fields. It was very effective as far as you could go. On the fifth day, what happened. Giorgio got his Jamara got his injunction, and he started hauling in illegals. And from that time on, it was just downhill all the way. The workers saw the illegals being hauled in, taking their jobs, and they got mad about that, and finally a lot of them went back to work, and that was it. So then we went out on a boycott against Jamara, we found out that after we'd been out on this boycott for a while, that there weren't any Jamara grapes. You know, the Jamara grape, the best one is known as Ara.
Aras.
Well, there weren't any Aras out there. No labels of Aras. Well, gee, could we have been that effective? Won the boycott already? Well, we found that was a big lie. What they'd done was to get the labels from about 70 other growers in the valley and put them on Jamara's boxes in order to fool us and the housewives, you know, and people bought the grapes. So that's when we decided that we had to put all the pressure we could on Jamara. We went back with about 50 farm workers in that old school bus, I think it's around here someplace, and I went back to New York, 50 farm workers and Dolores and I, and started moving against Victor Joseph, who was his head agent back there. And we had all kinds of committees calling on him day and night, the committee of youth, the committee of the Protestants, the committee of the Catholics, the committee of labor, and the committee of this, the committee of that, just keeping the sidewalks in front of that guy's house hot. But finally, we just decided that it couldn't be stopped. The guy wouldn't give in, and so we decided that the only thing we could do would be to go on an all-out, all-grape boycott. So in February, we went back there in January. By February, we came to that decision, and Caesar and Kircher gave in on it. Even though it was going to be kind of hard on DiGiorgio, you see, because he had table grapes too. And we were telling the people, don't buy grapes. And that included somebody we had under contract. So we had to be a little careful on that. But that's where the grape boycott was launched in February of 1968. In New York City, and after we'd broken in a number of the workers, they were dispatched to various places. Marcus went back to Boston, Elisei went back to Chicago. Some of the workers stayed there in New York, and then Joe came to L.A. I forgot who went to Washington and San Francisco. Well, but it all started up, and that was the national boycott. Well, in the meantime, you mentioned Goldberger, and I don't know very much about that strike, except I know Bustos and Eddie Frankel sort of were Pete Cardenas, yeah. And that was the second secret ballot election, or third. We won the second DiGiorgio. We won the Arvin DiGiorgio election about 2 months after we had won the Sierra Vista election in Delano. And then the Goldberg election came up right after that, and we won that one. That was the third secret ballot election.
That's where Manuel Rivera was run over by one.
That's right, by the truck.
Yeah.
That's right. Broke both his legs, didn't it? Ribs, yeah.
Then the union was going to sue him, and he went bankruptcy and went to Mexico or something.
Yeah. It was a relatively small grower. So that's the story leading more and more each year. As we went on the grape boycott, all of 68, all of 69. And by 69, though, some of the growers in Coachella Valley and Kovacevic wanted a meeting with the union down there. That was the first time that any growers had wanted a meeting. And so they had a meeting in the Coachella Valley in, around March or April or May or whatever it was in 1969. And that was a big feather in the cap of the union, because by then we knew that the boycott was really getting to them, or else
there were 11 growers
who met it. Including Kovacevic, who came down.
Esporo and Bianco.
Yeah. But we couldn't get them to agree, and I think the main obstacles were again the hiring hall and the pesticide control. They didn't want any mention of pesticides in that stuff, because they're afraid people would begin to think that they'd been poisoning them all these years, which they have. So However, it was a very, very good sign. We tightened up the boycott all over and expanded it. It became a national operation, an international operation. We had somebody over in Europe by that time. And the following year, of course, as you know, in July, the growers collapsed and met with the leadership of the union. I guess it was toward the end of July, I forgot.
Right,
29th? Uh-huh. And so all of those big growers got together and was it the American Legion Hall, is that where it was? Or Veterans Reform Hall?
St. Mary's Church.
Oh, is that where it was? They all went over there and signed it.
That's when John Jamar Jr. calls, he's at 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
John for a meeting.
Yeah, he came home from vacation or something.
He was there all day.
Yeah, they had, before he went on his vacations, I understand why, they'd all agreed that they were going to, you know, give in. And they were having negotiations. I went to one of them down at the, what's that big motel?
Stardust?
No. This was along the freeway south of Bakersfield. No, but you know what it is. They got all over the United States, wherever you turn around. Holly, and they were having negotiations down there. And this is something to put down. So this is where the Bishop's Committee comes in. Bishop's Committee was there negotiating between the growers and us. That was Monsignor Mahoney and Bishop, what's the Bishop's name? Dunley and Monsignor Higgins, right. All three over there. But the negotiations broke down. Well, then old Joe Jamar Sr. came home and found out, as soon as he found out what his grape situation was and that they had stopped negotiations, he got frantic about it, and that's when he went up and got Caesar and started the thing going again, because he was in control.
Was it 69?
No, that was 70, 1970.
But that time already the Coachella growers have signed up.
Yeah, that's right.
Coachella growers signed in 69?
No, they signed early 70. They had...
Coachella growers, well, actually, first two growers signed that year were Bianco and Spoto.
Yeah.
But they had grapes in the south.
And also over in Arizona.
In Arizona.
Yeah.
Then it just started. Then there's the Big Eight down there, Dimple, Richard Glass, and Bagdasari, and those guys. And it moved up to Pablo's area,
Steinberg,
and then in the Lane.
Yeah. I guess Steinberg was the first, wasn't he?
That's right.
Yeah.
I think it was Larson, and I don't remember exactly. It was Larson and Steinberg, or Larson and Bianco, but it was two.
It was Larson and Steinberg, then it was Bianco and Slow.
Oh, yeah. Well,
we also got a small tree fruit grower in Fresno in 70, April of 70, Roy Smith.
Pardon?
We also got a small tree fruit grower in Fresno in 1970, April.
Oh, yeah. What's he got? 3 acres up there?
Yeah, 200 acres.
Huh? 200 acres? Oh, well. He's
a former labor contractor.
Because in the valley, the first two to sign was Spoto Bianco, then it was Roberts, and then it was Roy Cement.
No. And we still have cement, don't we?
Yeah.
Well, then they had to start negotiations again. Get that out of the way. They had to get ratification. This is another thing to put down. They got the workers together to decide whether or not they wanted to ratify those contracts.
Who got the workers together? The union?
The union, right. In other words, it was not a backdoor thing. Because, you know, with a backdoor thing, there isn't any ratification involved. The teams would just move in and everything is taken care of for the grower. But We got ratification, we got all those contracts ratified by the workers. And as I recall, Marshall was in charge of getting that done down in the Bakersfield, Harvin area. And I believe Richard was in charge in the Delano area. And he had, well, he just had his, really had his hands full. Because when you see what happened was that practically overnight, from nothing or hardly anything in the way of contracts, we went up, or people under contract, we went up to 60,000 workers under contract. And workers who had not won those contracts by fighting for them, the people out of the boycott had won the contracts for them.
A handful.
Pardon?
A handful of people.
That's right. So that was a bad situation right there. And if other things hadn't come up, as they almost always do, we would have been able to do something about that bad situation to improve it. We tried later. In other words, we could have started to organize the workers at the point that we, you know, they became part of the union, and to organize it by crews, which we did in the Delano area later, and to get them to start fighting for their rights out in the ranch. Because that was just the beginning. The signing of the contract was just the very, very beginning of the fight of the workers and the ranch and the growers. The growers, although they signed the contract, as we'll see later, they did everything they could to sabotage those contracts later on. And but we didn't have that luxury of time on hand, as we almost never do, because almost the next day before, I think they were just barely starting, somebody almost, just starting to take a drink to celebrate this big victory. He got the wire and the telephone calls and all the rest from Salinas. And the Teamsters were all over the fields over there. They didn't even get to celebrate the big victory. They had to organize.
They had already signed the contract.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, we were signing up, you know, in behalf of the workers over here. The Teamsters were signing up in behalf of the company. Over there at Salinas.
Yeah.
That's what it boiled down to, because it was another instance of the backdoor sweetheart contract combination.
70.
Yeah.
July
of 70.
What time did they actually sign the same thing?
Well, I can remember.
It was like about a week before
something. No, I can remember it was like the workers knew about it. One day before the lot of organizations arrived from the event farm.
Just one day, yeah.
One day before.
Right.
What they told us, you know, you just sign up for the
deal. Well, see what, Manuel, a lot of those lettuce workers, you see, come from Mexico, Imperial Valley and Mexicali and so forth. Manuel had already signed up a lot of them down there. And then Luna and Pancho Boteo had been signing him up over there in the field over there in Salinas. So we already had a lot of them signed up already. We've been working, you know, our people were over there organizing workers while the teachers were organizing the growers. And
it's a shortcut.
Yeah, right. So then Leroy brought all of his Gente up from Los Angeles, and they started parading up the valley from the south
from the north and south.
Yeah, and the people from San Francisco came down parading from the north, and they got a lot of the workers in the lines and, you know, parading up the valley and so forth. And they all met at the college down there. What's the name of that college? Hartnell College, and Caesar was there, and they met afterwards and made plans for beginning the organizing work over in the valley. And so what we did was they'd gotten started on the wrong foot. They were trying to organize by districts. They'd split up the valley in various districts. Well, that wasn't the right way to organize, because some of the big companies had fields in each of those districts that had to be organized by companies instead of by districts. So we had to, you know, turn around. And but as Robert said, while we were out getting the workers on these various ranches signed up, we had crews of organizers assigned to each of the big ranches, you know, and they went out to the workers where they lived in the camps and on the fields and so forth, signing them up on our own authorization cards. While we were doing this, one day the workers Fresh Pick was lettuce and artichokes and radish, whatever, celery. And they came in, told us what Robert just said, that they'd been given an ultimatum. You either sign, you had 10 days, and I think it was the 8th day or the 9th day or something, to sign these, sign up for having their, you know, sign up as Teamster members and having the dues taken out of their checks. That night, we told them to go back and bring the workers together, and we discussed it. We got together that night, and they voted to go on strike rather than sign up with the Teamsters. And that wasn't any put-up job, right? Throughout the whole damn valley. We didn't have to do it. The workers organized themselves practically, right? And in other words, we didn't start that strike. The workers started the strike. And demanded that we help, you know, help. And all Marshall could do, Marshall and I were in a, we rented an old post office, an ex-post office building. And that thing was just jam-packed all day long. And the workmen, we had a little office in the back. Well, forget about that. Workers were all in there, too. And we couldn't talk to each other hardly. We couldn't hear each other on the phone. Or, you know, it's just a mess.
About 10 poles in there.
Huh? Yeah, right. That's right. All we could do would be get the workers out of the way to rush from one phone to the other. And so all we could do would be when they come in and say, look, we want your help, we'd say, well, go back and get organized and come in. And we do what we can to help. Right?
They were back in 5 minutes.
Yeah, right, just about. So they did. They went out and got their committee together, took a vote of the workers and their ranches. They did, you know, they did this all by themselves, and because they knew what they wanted and knew how to go about doing it, and they just needed a little explanation of what it was their union required, you know, in order to okay the strike. I don't know what they would have done if we had said no. Well, we did say no once to Bud Adel's workers, you know, before we finally took them in. Well, but everybody, then we all got together again on the following Sunday and over at Hartnell College again, and they all came out by ranch. They all marched onto the field like it was like a college football game or something. Each ranch of workers marched out of the field. Some of them came in their special uniforms that they had, you know. Remember those ones that had the yellow uniforms? Gee, they were so bright you could see them for miles. They all had the red flags. Just all that valley was nothing but red flags. I never saw so many red flags in my life. You couldn't stick your head out a window without seeing a flock of cars with red flags going by. And so they voted. So then Caesar would call each one, you know, by whatever the guy's name was.
Bruce Church
or whatever it was, Blue Shirts. Call it. And then they'd say, we vote to strike. What'd they say?
They would say, well, I wasn't there, but I was scattered.
Yeah.
We know that. They would say, you know, company so-and-so, you know, what's your vote?
Yeah.
And everybody would yell, strike.
Yeah. So that they did that all afternoon, everybody, and they sang, and Caesar made a speech, and so forth, and so that's how the whole thing started.
What was the date of that?
So that was in the, what was that, about the 15th or 16th of August, around about the middle of the year. Yeah.
We started somewhere on the
15th. Yeah.
I was there.
Yeah.
Not the college, but the day before when they had all the marchers coming in.
Well,
I didn't just go to Delano.
Well, the first group, the first worker first workers to go out were fresh picked. They went out the next morning after they took that boat that I told you about. And then we fainted, like, you know, a boxer faints. We pretended like we were going to pull a boycott on fresh picked product, a product that they had in the market. Huh?
Purex.
Pretended like we were going to boycott it, and that scared fresh picked. So they agreed to sit down and negotiate. So negotiations started.
Was it first Chiquita?
Huh? No. And that came next.
Yeah.
It's true. But Inner Harbor was more scared because of Chiquita. So then we decided it was the next most vulnerable ranch. Well, it was more vulnerable, but the workers on Fresh Pick beat us to the punch. They came and demanded the strike. So then we decided, the next most vulnerable one was Inner Harbor, because they're part of United Fruit and probably another big thing.
You know the guys that came from Salinas to talk to Caesar about the strike order?
Pardon me?
The guys that came to talk to Caesar.
They came from New York or something?
No, they came from Salinas, because then they came, you know, like when the strike was going to get started, when the teachers got there.
Yeah.
It was Fidel, Carlos Valencia, and...
Fidel from
Winter Harvest.
Blue Shirt.
Blue Shirt. Hello, Valencia from Winter Harvest.
Yeah.
And there was two more guys.
Yeah.
Those were the guys that came in for the call.
So then they decided that the next one would be Inner Harvests, and they threatened to boycott Chiquita Bananas. And as a matter of fact, I think they made some telephone calls in the East and scared some of their big agents back there.
Yeah.
And I think they had one little picket line someplace, and that was the extent of the boycott. And Inner Harvest decided that they didn't want that, and so they agreed to have a card check election. See, we had card check elections, I forgot to mention this, in connection with those wine grape contracts with Almaden, Palmason, and so forth. Now we had a card check election. Pardon? Well, card check, we had signed up about 1,200 Inner Harvest workers on these authorization cards, authorizing the union. The worker authorized the union to represent them in dealing with the company. And so we had about 1,200 that we'd already gotten the workers to sign. So we agreed that we'd have this card check election. And we did, and this is the second time that the bishops came into the act. The bishops' committee was there, and they counted the ballots. Monsignor Higgins, and what was the priest name that was there? Father, you know, he was in charge of the accounting, giving out the money and all that. What's that? What's the priest's name?
Father
Duran.
Duran,
yeah. El Padre más Padre de Salinas.
Huh?
El Padre más Padre de Salinas.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
The guy with the money.
Yeah. So, of course, you know, the Teamsters didn't have all that many. Well, actually, it wasn't a question of the Teamsters being having any, because they didn't have any cards at all. It was a question of our being able to show that more workers from Inter Harvest favored the union than didn't favor the union. In other words, we had to get at least one card more than half of the people on their payroll, the workers on their payroll, and we did. I don't know how many more, but more than half. So, and that was certified too by the Bishop's Committee. And then we got a moratorium to the, you know, negotiating between the Teamsters and us, the bishops. We got a moratorium, during which time Grammy, who was the big honcho in that strike, agreed that, we had our second pact. Right, and it was the same, it was a repetition of the first one. See, the Teamsters broke the first one. Well, now they signed another one. And agreed to stay out of fields and so forth. And that they would get the contracts rescinded. See, this is another word to put down. The Grammy agreed that he would go around and get all his contracts rescinded. See, we already had Interharvest contract rescinded when they sat down to bargain. I don't know whether we got Fresh Picks rescinded right then or a little while later. We got both of them to get their contracts rescinded. And that meant that both the company and the Teamsters agreed to let us have the contract and to rescind the agreement between them, between those two.
What was the contract?
What rescinded mean? Rescinded, well, it means to do away with the agreement as expressed in the contract between the Teamsters and the Groves. It means to nullify or, you know, terminate or whatever. Yeah. There's probably a word in Spanish that's somewhat similar to it. I think I can't think what it is. So,
anular.
Huh?
Anular.
Yeah, that's the same. Right. No. So we stopped the strike then against Interharvest and against Fresh Pick. And then we went out and strike against all of the companies. And the workers, as I said, voted by their elected committees to go on strike. In other words, this was so far from anything that the Teamsters had ever done, you know. Well, the workers just had complete control. Well, almost. And so then we were striking over 7,500 workers. The LA Times said it was the largest strike in farm labor history. I think what they meant was it's the largest strike involving a large number of people simultaneously.
How many? 7,500?
Over 7,500. And this is all, you know, this isn't anything that we made up. You could just, for once, the growers are being heard.
You know, the funny part about it, the first thing, you know, like, they would meet at 4 o'clock to go picket. Everybody would go picket. And then they come in until about 5 o'clock. Then they would have the general meeting, you know, with everybody. Then after that, they would have a meeting with the picket captains. Then after that, they would have a meeting with the coordinators. Then after that, they would have another meeting with the boycotters. Then after that, they would have another meeting with seizures. So, you know, it just went constantly. Just around the clock.
I was averaging 3 hours sleep a night.
That's what almost everybody was doing that. You know.
Yeah. I didn't know which way I was going most of
the time. Then they have to go have a meeting at the Morales camp or at some other camp, you know.
Yeah, I guess that's the only thing that kept us going. Excitement. So, but you know, all that didn't last very long. You know what happened next? Growers got the injunctions. This time they got the worst injunction of all. They got an injunction against the strike, not just an injunction limiting the picket line or the use of the bullhorn or something like that, which we were used to, but against the whole strike. Well, for a while, the cops didn't try to enforce that injunction, so we continued to picket. But then the growers forced the cops into action. And they started making mass arrests toward the end over there. And then the Teamsters started into their violence. So this is the third. Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, this is. There were shots fired. Fortunately, nobody was hit. Rifle shots fired at the pickets, or in the direction, general direction of the pickets.
The security officers. They were in the army guards.
Yeah.
The shotguns were.
That's right. They were
handsome.
Right. And then the worst instance of it was when our own attorney Jerry Coleman, and this same guy that I mentioned to you a while ago, Levy, Jacques Levy, who was our PR guy over there, and Venustiano Odin, who was in charge of the Montreal, went out into Hanson, the big grower down there by the name of Hanson. What did he grow?
Cauliflower.
He had the guys with the yellow uniforms.
That's where I was working.
Oh, you were working there? You had the yellow uniform?
What? See, these guys came out on strike one day, the company that I was with. Came out on strike one day. And I don't know what kind of plan they made, you know, but they sent them back in. And they had everything planned. Everybody had their flags tucked in into their, you know, their jacket. And they had a certain hour to pull out their flags and just sit back. I don't know what kind of a plan it was, you know. Because, we, you know, the first day they went on a strike, and then, you know, next day they show up to work, and we, you know, oh, you chicken shit, guys. We knew you couldn't make it. We knew you'd come back crawling to the company and all that, you know. And then they scared the shit out of you, you know, when they pull all those red flags.
Oh, yeah.
There was one guy that was driving a high toe. He jumped off the high toe, and the high toe just went rolling by itself.
Where'd you call that?
Huh?
Hi, Joe.
Yeah, it's a tractor where they put bins, you know.
Oh, right.
And they bring them into the field because they were broccoli cutters, you know. And so all of a sudden, you know, all we see is just somebody jump and say, well, the guy, you know, and here comes the flags. And this guy was driving the high toe. He saw him coming back, you know.
No,
so he
driving.
Just jumped off the, just let it go by itself.
Well, at any rate, Jerry was in there to investigate something. We wanted to talk to the workers anyway. See if there are any workers still in there, because they got some grievance report or something. And they got inside, walking, just, you know, they weren't trying to get to the workers to try and get them out of there or anything, just to talk to them to see if they had this grievance. And they were met, suddenly some pickups started coming toward them. Were you there when that happened?
No, I got taken the bus.
Oh. And some big guy, he weighed between 270 and 300 pounds. You remember his name?
Clemens.
He just died.
Yeah.
He died?
Yeah, they operated on him for obesity. He died.
Wow.
Jerry was really upset.
Yeah, sure. His buddy, was his buddy. So, at a certain point, they got closer together while Hanson yelled to these big guys, there were three of them, and told them to get him, go get him. So they went after him, and one of them got a hold of Jerry, and the other took care of Miss Deanna, knocked them all down, and they had to go to the hospital. This big guy got a hold of Jerry like this, and somehow they stumbled out to the edge of the property. Right then, some cops came along. And here was Jerry, practically half dead, you know, lying there on the ground. The cop comes up to him and said, listen, Cohen, you've got to get your guys out of here. They're going to be taking you. We're going to start arresting your guys. And here's the poor Jerry.
Kind of trespassing.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So they went to the hospital. Jerry had a concussion. Boy, he was in bad shape. And the other two were in bad shape. Two were not as bad as Jerry. So... Then they started making mass arrests, and we just couldn't. Of course, we appealed that injunction right away, but you know how long it took. It took 2 years before we got the ruling on the injunction. Went up to the state Supreme Court.